Graham Summers, President and Chief Market Strategist for Phoenix Capital Research. Welcome to the Competent Investor.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Graham, I'm looking forward to this conversation for the since we booked it over the last couple of weeks here, and I came across an article that you had written at the end of October entitled "The Trump Administration is Going to Revalue Gold in 2026." So this was a response to Luke Gromans' tweet on the subject of gold revaluation. And you pointed out that this is, there's legislation that is being introduced into Congress as part of building the strategic Bitcoin reserve. So what are the details of this bill and where is it currently at within the process of becoming law?
Sure. So let's sort of paint a big picture of how this whole situation unfolded. So as most people are aware, the United States has a debt problem. We've created essentially a bubble in our sovereign bonds, which are called treasuries. I actually coined the term the everything bubble back in 2014, wrote the bestseller by the same name in 2017. And the idea behind that book is essentially that once we cut off the gold standard, the bedrock of our financial system became US debt or treasuries. Now, that's particularly significant for a number of ways. One is that there was starting in 1971, and especially once we got into the secular bull market in bonds that began in 82, there's no real sort of limit to the amount of money the United States could produce or the credit it could funnel into its financial system. And if you look at sort of a chart of GDP relative to total debt in the financial system, they move kind of in tandem to like 1971, and then debt goes up quite a bit, and GDP stays much lower. And as a result of that, by the time we got to the late 90s, we got to a situation where there was so much debt in our financial system that any sort of threat of debt deflation, and debt deflation is the process through which debt becomes worth less on its way to becoming worthless, was such that it was a systemic issue. And so from that point on, we started this era of what I call the era of serial bubbles, where the Federal Reserve, which is our central bank, essentially entered into this policy of permitting asset bubbles to unfold. And then when those bubbles burst, as all bubbles do, allow a larger bubble in a more senior asset class to be created. So the first main bubble we have is the tech bubble in the late 90s. That was a bubble isolated specifically to technology stocks, which at the time was really an asset class a lot of people didn't know. And I think stock ownership was only about 25% of American households in the late 90s. You fast forward, that bubble crashes. The Fed then creates a bubble in real estate, which is the senior most, a much more senior asset class, as you can imagine. Opening up a brokerage account, buying a stock takes whatever, a couple hours. You can do it for a few dollars. Typically, a home is the largest transaction of anyone's life. When that bubble burst, and that bubble became truly systemic through the sort of over-the-counter derivatives market, which is where they bundled up all that garbage. People talked about this ad nauseum, so I won't bore everyone. But when that bubble burst, the Fed then pushed to create a bubble in treasuries. And they specifically did that in two ways. One was they cut interest rates to zero, which dragged treasuries on the short end down. And then they launched quantitative easing, which is you print money and you use it to buy treasuries on the long end, which pulled that down. So you created this completely artificial landscape of risk because the yields on treasuries are the risk-free rate of return against which every risk asset, whether it's stocks or real estate, oil even, are valued. And so when they created this bubble in treasuries, they were effectively creating a bubble in everything. And this is what really allowed the United States to go on this kind of massive debt binge. It took us over 230 years to get our first 10 trillion in public debt. We added the next 10 trillion in 9, the next 10 trillion after that in 5, and now it looks like we're going to add the fourth one in about 3.5. And the reason a lot of that happened, the reason that accelerated, was because starting in the middle 2000s, the Federal Reserve was essentially manipulating the entire treasury market in such a way that the United States was allowed to just issue all this debt without interest rates spiking. So you fast forward to the pandemic, and that was the big game changer because as long as inflation didn't enter the financial system, the US could get away with this kind of paradigm they were in. When the pandemic hit, we got inflation. It was a one-two punch. On the supply side, you had the supply chains disrupted, which consequently, things were scarcer, harder to get a hold of, so costs went up. And on the flip side, on the demand side, the Federal Reserve printed $5 trillion. the U.S. government printed $6 trillion, and they funneled into the financial system that's been about 20 months. So you've got this massive amount of stimulus and free money coming in, which increased demand. So you've got supply coming down, demand going up, inflation comes to the financial system. And when that happened, the treasury market, balked, as it's inclined to do. And as a result, yields just spiked. And that's what triggered this bear market in stocks and bonds we had in 2022. So that, getting out of that, the Federal Reserve, went on one of the most aggressive rate hike schedules it's ever had. It launched quantitative tightening, and they were essentially in the process of blowing up the bond bubble when they sort of panicked and reversed course. And the reason they reversed course is they figured out what everybody's currently figuring out, which is that by allowing governments, as everyone knows, likes to issue debt. They like to pay for things with debt. And when the central banks were artificially suppressing interest rates, it allowed governments to go on even crazier debt binges. And that's why I wrote the second book, Into the Abyss, which is all about sort of the pandemic and what happened financially during that time. But the reality is, we never returned to pre-pandemic normalcy. All of the governments around the world, whether you look at Japan, European Union, United States, they're all running deficits relative to GDP that never went back to what was normal before the pandemic. So you've got this situation where we already had a lot of debt in the system. Pandemic hits, they go on an insane debt binge to finance all their stimulus efforts. And now there's just an obscene amount of debt out there, and it's growing exponentially at a rapid clip. So we get to the situation where I penned that article about revaluing gold because, historically, there's three ways you deal with debt. One is you grow out of it, two is you default, and three is you inflate it away, you devalue the currency. And the United States, there's really no particular way we could grow out of the debt. We'd have to get into a situation where growth was so aggressive. It's just mathematically, it's not really possible. Secondarily, you can't default on US debt because if the US defaulted, it would cause a systemic crisis that would make 2008 look like a picnic. Why do I say that? Because the over-the-counter derivatives market, everyone knows about over-the-counter derivatives and related to mortgage securities, which caused the 08 crisis. That market at its peak was only 50, 60 trillion in size. The over-the-counter derivatives market for interest rates, specifically interest rates related to bonds and treasuries, is five, tenfold that market. It's something like in the US alone, there's like $200 trillion worth of derivatives that trade based on treasury bonds. So if we ever defaulted, that whole thing would just blow up and you'd make, great financial crisis look like a walk in the park. So we can't do that. So the third option is deflate it away, which historically that's what central banks do. They print money, they try to devalue the currency. The idea is you're going to pay your debt off with currency that's worth less, and consequently it's more financially feasible.
It always seems to be the most palatable option, right?
Yeah, it works until it doesn't, and then they all default. I mean, nobody's ever successfully inflated away debts, really. There's just been situations where the final medicine isn't as unpalatable as it was originally. So when the Trump administration came into office, and I apologize for such a long-winded answer, they initially were like, we're going to balance the budget. We're going to use DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency, to cut costs, and then we're going to raise revenues through tariffs. And we're going to also implement this really aggressive trade war that's going to start making everybody paying us tariff revenue. And we're also going to try and boost the economy and get growth to give us higher tax revenues. That lasted about 2 months. And DOGE started getting limited in the courts via lawfare and other manners. Elon Musk bails. And during the tariff war, when we were in that mini meltdown in late March, early April, the bond market started to revolt. And not a lot of people picked up on it, but the Trump administration did a complete pivot. And from that point on, it was no longer we're going to balance the budget. It was we're going to run it hot. We're going to focus on growth by any means possible, even if it risks another inflationary storm. That's how we're going to get out of this situation. We're going to devalue the currency. We're going to push asset prices as high as we possibly can. And we're going to run the economy hot, meaning we're going to have the economy grow while simultaneously running the largest deficits as a percentage of GDP outside of World War II, while pushing the Fed to cut rates and make money cheaper. And their argument at the time was, well, we're going to try and grow our way out of the debt situation because if growth is high enough, we're going to get it to a situation where tax revenues will be so high that our debt as a percentage of GDP will come down. But then they said something really interesting, which not a lot of people picked up on, which was Bessent, Scott Bessent, who's the Treasury Secretary, said, we're going to monetize the asset side of the US balance sheet. So you've got the assets, the things the US owns, and then you've got the debts that it owes. And when Bessent said that, people sort of freaked out. We're like, well, what does that mean? And the only asset the United States owns that it could really monetize is its gold holdings. Because, I mean, you could technically, the real estate that the US government owns is valued at a much lower than market rate, but that would only give them about $50 billion if they revalued everything. But the gold holdings we have are valued at $42 per ounce, gold's at 4,000. So if they revalued gold, it would immediately free up somewhere between 800 and $800 billion and $1 trillion in capital. And that's when I started digging deeper into this. You go and look at the Bitcoin Act, and in there is actually an open statement that what they want to do is revalue. It's Section 9. They want to revalue the gold holdings and use the capital that frees up to finance the strategic Bitcoin reserve. But if you think about it, going from that to a leap of revaluing gold at a much higher rate, $10,000, $20,000 an ounce, you free up potentially $5 trillion in capital for the United States, which could, we could retire something like 18, 20% of our debt outstanding. And you do that without necessarily creating another inflationary wave because the capital would just stay in the financial system. It wouldn't actually flow in directly into the economy. And we've got the Treasury Secretary saying he wants to monetize the asset side of the balance sheet. You've got a president who's famous in commercial real estate for revaluing his assets as high as possible to get the best, loan rates possible. I mean, this is right up the Trump administration's alley. And I think if push comes to shove, there's a really significant chance they could go for this. For anyone who says, well, that's just crazy conspiracy theory, I mean, it's literally what FDR did with the Gold Reserve Act, or the Gold Act in 1934. They basically confiscated gold. I don't think Trump would do that. But then they revalued gold from whatever it was, $23 an ounce, like 36 or something like that. And through that, they freed up all this money. They used it to pay off debt. They used it to launch infrastructure projects. I mean, you can say what you want about the president, but the guy's not an idiot. He's certainly very sophisticated when it comes to financial engineering. And this presents kind of a fourth option for the United States, aside from grow out of it, default, inflate it away, revalue your assets, use that to retire debt, finance infrastructure, and potentially get the debt situation on sounder footing. So, I mean, I don't think this is something that he would do anytime. I originally said 2026, but I think it's probably coming after the midterms if they try this. They've got to avoid giving too much fodder to the Democrats for the midterms. And this would definitely be a controversial move. So I apologize for that long-winded answer, but that's kind of the big picture how to think about our financial system right now.
Absolutely, Graham. I mean, there's a bunch of different tangents there to kind of explain, but let's start with what you kind of finished with there. Why is that a controversial move if it won't create more inflation, if it gives us some breathing room on the balance sheet, and why would that give the Democrats more fodder?
Well, I mean, I don't like to talk too much. I used to do a lot of political analysis, and then I quickly discovered that people don't actually want to hear anything resembling reality. They just want to hear something that confirms their biases. So I stopped doing it. But, unfortunately, we're in a situation where political animosity is so high that the Trump administration could probably come out and say the sky's blue and the Democrats would attack him for who knows what. I mean, there's just such animosity between the two parties. So even if this is a great idea, which I think it is, I think Trump would get attacked for it. And the way they'd attack him would be you're going to devalue the dollar too much. You're going to like unleash inflation. I mean, the reality is, as much as everyone talks about wanting to fix the debt, nobody ever is willing to take the medicine that it requires. I think politically it's unpalatable. It would have to be something that the administration does when they've got no real concerns about political cost, namely, it's the second half of the second term of the president and he's not looking for re-election. So I would, or, they're forced by a debt crisis, but that's, that would have to happen first. And I mean, typically you can get these kind of big moves when there's a crisis, as Rahm Emanuel, who was the former chief of staff for Obama, said, never let a good crisis go to waste. So, if a crisis hit before that, it's possible they might make that move then. But they've kind of hinted at it previously. They talk about auditing Fort Knox. You've got the Treasury Secretary saying, let's monetize the asset side of the balance sheet. Well, the only asset they own that would really free up significant capital would be gold. There's the legislation for the in the Bitcoin Act. The president's, bananas about Bitcoin. He just the other day said the most important thing to me is we're number one for crypto. It's kind of you can connect the dots and see they're laying the groundwork for something like this. So that's what really made me pen that article, because the reality is we're in this weird situation where no matter what happens, it's hard to find a situation where gold's going to do badly going forward, unless you have a real like another major financial crisis, because during financial crises, correlations always go to one. It doesn't matter how great an investment is, everything sells off. So gold would definitely, if we had like another 08 or another COVID crash, something like that, gold would do poorly. But from a purely macro perspective, outside of that context, you're in a situation where it's become very clear that the only thing policymakers know how to do is print money. They don't know how to really create jobs. They don't know how to boost incomes. They just know how to print money and use it to buy things. And by doing that, suppressing the price of those things, or excuse me, suppressing the interest rates on those things. That was what COVID really taught us. Up until that point, every time a crisis hit, policymakers would introduce maybe one or two plays from their playbook. But COVID was so rapid, it was so violent. The 08 crisis, which scarred a lot of people forget that took like 16 months to unfold, really. COVID, the whole thing, peak to trough was like 6, 8 weeks. And because it was so violent, because everything happened so rapidly, the Fed was forced to just pull out all the stops and show, it showed its whole playbook to us. And the playbook consists of nothing but cut rates to zero and then just print money and use it to buy things. Like they don't know anything else. And given the fact that we're in this environment where there's so much debt in the system, and this is global, I'm picking on the Fed because I'm in the US, but European Central Bank, Bank of Japan, everyone's in the same boat. excuse me. Because we're in this situation where there's so much excess debt and governments are not willing to actually cut fiscal spending, central banks really have no option but to print money and use it to buy assets again. And I think the markets figured this out. That's why in 2024, you saw gold break out against every major currency. You saw it break out against the dollar, the euro, the yen, the franc, everything. I think the market suddenly realized that there's no path forward that doesn't just involve more money printing. And so, from the big picture perspective, regardless of whether the Trump administration does decide to revalue gold, it's hard to find a situation where gold doesn't do, relatively well in the next 3 to 5 years.
So, Graham, let's talk through a little bit about, let's say, the downstream consequences of a possible, gold revaluation. Does this really serve to strengthen the dollar's standing and kind of reestablish the idea of a gold backing to the dollar?
Yeah, I agree. I think it would create an implicit tie to the dollar, which, I mean, it would be very interesting because obviously if you revalue gold, the dollar is being devalued because the price of gold's going up relative to the dollar. So the dollar would be devalued in the short term, but in the bigger picture, it would become the first major currency that has an implicit link to gold again since 1971. Up until, let's see, so gold was pegged to major currencies until 1967 when France first broke from it. And then after that, they were like dominoes, culminating in the US with Nixon ending the gold standard in 1971, August of 71. So yeah, if we revalued our gold and priced it at market or higher, there's an implicit link between the dollar and gold that didn't previously exist, because the reality is that our gold holdings go up so much in value. We retire debt, our financial standing gets stronger, but also our gold holdings are now valued at market or higher, which no one else does. Everyone else is owning gold at these discounted rates. It strengthens the dollar because it signals to the financial system that our gold holdings, we see them as significant as an asset that we own. And therefore, the link between the dollar and gold becomes implicitly tied, which would, in a way, make the dollar something of a gold-backed currency again.
Well, yeah, it's funny because I was thinking about it from the opposite standpoint of if you signal to the market that you have all this gold and that you are valuing it at fair market price, just starting there, then I was thinking that that could serve to strengthen the dollar, which is kind of contrary to Bessent and I believe Lutnick's statements about needing a weaker dollar to facilitate trade, to facilitate exports, pieces like that. So it's kind of, trying to figure out the all of these downstream effects of that ends up being the tricky part, right?
Yeah, the problem with these big policy moves is there's always unintended consequences. I presented this as a sort of fourth path forward for dealing with the debt that when push comes to shove, I think is probably more palatable than some of the other options. But this is down the road. I mean, we're not in a situation where this is an urgent, needs to happen right now. It's just interesting how all the pieces are kind of lining up,
Yeah, I mean, of course, that's I think as gold investors, we kind of have to be paying attention to these things, or not necessarily gold investors, but good investors in general try to see these trends before they develop, right? So
The flip side of it too is we have to consider we might be closer to debt crisis than we think. We're focusing on the United States where, our debt is treasuries, but the grandfather of monetary insanity is the Bank of Japan. The Fed first introduced zero interest rate policy and quantitative easing in 2008. Bank of Japan introduced ZIRP in 99, QE in 2001. And since that time, if you think the Fed's crazy, the Bank of Japan's like out of this world nuts. They've effectively nationalized their entire financial system. Their debt to GDP is over 200%. The Bank of Japan's balance sheet's larger than Japan's GDP. Bank of Japan's the top 10 shareholder for most of the Nikkei 225. They own over 50% of Japan's debt. They own so much of the debt. There's days where certain denominations of debt don't even trade anymore. I mean, it's mind-boggling. They actually launched the craziest thing they ever did, which a lot of people missed, was in 2014, they launched a quantitative easing program equal to 25% of GDP. I mean, for the US to do that, we'd have to launch like an $8 trillion, QE program. I mean, it was just insanity. And the big story, one of the systemic risks I'm noticing right now is that Japan's starting to lose control of its bond market. The bond market in Japan, as I commented earlier, the Bank of Japan owns over 50% of Japan's debt. And the problem with all of this is that Japan, like everyone else, has inflation now. And when inflation comes in, bond prices sell off and yields go up. And in that situation, the yield on long-term Japanese debt is spiking to levels you haven't seen since 07 or 08. Now, why does that matter? Well, it matters because they've got so much more debt than they did back then. And they never actually cut off their QE programs that they've been engaged in. And they just had the first female prime minister win office. And her primary policy is she wants to be fiscally aggressive. They want to do $110 billion, or whatever it is in yen, but in dollars is 110 billion stimulus program. And all of this is happening when their bond market's starting to blow up. So that's a situation where, we talk about a debt crisis hitting. Well, if it's going to hit, it's probably going to start in Japan. They're the furthest down the monetary insanity rabbit hole. And that's actually starting to get kind of hairy. And we actually had a first taste of it in August, late July, early August of 2024. It happened so fast that we sort of blinked and it was over. But, stocks lost like 10% in 3 days or something like that. And it was because the Japan basically raised interest rates trying to arrest inflation, and it started blowing up the yen carry trade. And, we're getting to a situation where, rubber's going to have to hit the road with Japan. And if they do implement these fiscal policies they're talking about, it's very difficult to see an environment where their yields don't just keep spiking, which, the implications of that are massive. They lose control of their bond market. If the Bank of Japan decides to print more money and use it to buy those bonds, then the yen just completely implodes. The Bank of Japan starts becoming insolvent because all the bonds it owns are selling off. I mean, it's so we might be closer than people think. Like this idea of revaluing gold or like some kind of like nuclear Hail Mary to address debt, that might be closer than people think if you start seeing sovereign defaults in countries like Japan.
Do you think that during that time that much of the Japanese yen carry trade has been unwound, or do you think a lot of that debt and a lot of that mismatch of borrowing to buy US assets or other assets worldwide that had a higher yield, has that been unwound to a reasonable amount that doesn't necessarily present the same type of effect that it did when the carry trade originally started to unwind?
You know, I have a policy. I really try to steer clear of talking too much about things that I'm not really well versed on. The yen
Totally.
carry trade I'm familiar with, but I haven't looked at the numbers recently. I couldn't. Obviously it's unwound to a significant degree because you couldn't have the bonds selling off like they are without that happening. But I don't have the actual data that I could talk knowledgeably about that. The yen carry trade is a massive carry trade. And yeah, I'm sorry. It's just a little bit
No,
outside my wheelhouse.
not a problem, Graham. That's a I appreciate the honest answer. That's good.
I try to steer clear of talking about stuff that I'm not really well versed in. Just the world's so full, especially in investing, these guys who think they're masters of the universe and every single thing they're knowledgeable about. And the reality is, it's a lot more complicated than a lot of people make out.
Well, I mean, I do my best to try to present truth or something as close to the truth as we can get here,
Yeah, appreciate it.
whether that's palatable or not. You know, I came across another example yesterday. I was listening to a different podcast, and the host had mentioned that there was a that Sam Altman had made comments towards asking the Fed to back these AI data centers. And after I, you know, tried to find an actual source of that, it turns out it wasn't true. But you know, then you can carry that forward and propagate that piece of misinformation. So you know, it is what it is. So I appreciate the
That's
honest
very
answer
what.
there.
Sorry, I apologize. That's a really good point. Something a lot of not many people, I don't think many people know this, but we're in an environment where hedge funds, they plant stories in the media. You kind of an example of this would be with UnitedHealth Group, the sort of embattled health insurer. I mean, everyone's familiar of all the problems that company has, but what people might not know is that, the media kept coming out with these stories about like new problems, like new major things that were unfolding. And then you dig a little deeper, and it wasn't new at all. It was stuff that had actually already been investigated and had been cleared by the Department of Justice. And you wonder, well, where did this come from? And like my sense of a lot of this stuff is I think hedge funds pay reporters to plant stories to help them with their shorts or whatever it is they own. And I mean, we know for a fact the media takes money in exchange for stories from foreign governments, and we know that that's also that hedge funds do the same thing. Hedge funds go on Reddit and plant stories to try and get retailers into some of their positions. So it's very difficult to find accurate information, especially since a lot of the pillars of sort of the financial media have been corrupted. And it, you know, I'm not trying to just poke fun at them. The reality is a lot of those companies are so massively in debt, they'll do anything to get, money to try and shore up their finances. So it is what it is.
So, Graham, I wanted to go back to this idea of where, let's say, the US government ends up. And I suppose we should be more specific there too. It would have to be the Treasury that has to revalue the holdings, right?
Yeah, so what would happen, the way it's laid out in the Bitcoin Act is that the Fed technically is the custodian of gold certificates for the Treasury. So what would happen was the certificates would go back to the Treasury. The Treasury would then revalue them and then transfer it back to the Fed. And in so doing, the capital's freed up and the Fed returns the cash to the Treasury and the Fed prints the money, gives it to the Treasury, and the Treasury does what it wants, essentially. Yeah. So it never. It's like the money never actually really goes into the economy in any real way. It's just moving. You're basically talking about like moving things across a ledger, but capital comes into the ledger.
And to just, I guess, reiterate where this bill actually is. It's only been introduced. It hasn't made it through the House of Commons, hasn't made it through the Senate. So it
No,
is, it's not
it's
law
there.
yet.
No, it's not law yet. That's correct. Yeah.
So anyway, going back to this idea of where they actually end up revaluing gold too. If we do it at market rate versus
Yeah.
doing it at, let's say, $10,000 or $20,000 an ounce,
Mm-hmm.
as you mentioned, that at $4,000 an ounce, that frees up somewhere between 800 billion to $1 trillion in new capital.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
However, if they did it higher, this would seem to benefit them more because we can then we then have the ability to pay off more of that debt or whatever they decide to end up using that capital for. So what do you think of the possibility of them revaluing it to a much higher price than the current market value of around 4,000?
Well, it depends on what approach they want to take, right? So, currently the way it's laid out in the legislation is they'd use it to finance the strategic Bitcoin reserve, which let's say they don't revalue to a higher price. Like let's say they decide the debt's not our problem, we're going to kick the can like everyone else does, and that could be the next administration's problem. You could monetize the balance sheet by, if you revalue at 4,000 an ounce, the gold holdings at 4,000 an ounce, and you free up, say, 800 billion. Well, the Treasury then uses that to start the strategic, Bitcoin reserve. I mean, Bitcoin's only $3 trillion. What are they going to buy, like 30% of all the Bitcoin in the world? And you can imagine what that would do to the price of Bitcoin. So, you're basically talking about the United States becoming a speculator in crypto, which, as we all know, crypto can make just obscene amounts of money. So maybe that's what they're, up to, is they're trying to just use it to buy Bitcoin, pump the hell out of Bitcoin, and consequently get trillions of dollars in gains from that and use that to pay off the debt. I don't know. My view was simply, if you look at the actual math, and this is kind of a one-time Hail Mary, why not just revalue at a much higher price? It's been done before. We know that the financial system could stomach it. You'd only get away with this by doing it at a time when things are under duress, but you could retire as much as 10, 18, 20% of the debt outstanding. The US immediately financially is on a sounder footing. You've done it without actually even selling the gold that we own. You're implicitly linking the gold to the dollar again, which establishes the dollar. Just guarantees the dollar is the reserve currency of the world for the near future. It kind of ticks a lot of boxes. And it's, as I mentioned earlier, this is essentially what Trump himself did throughout most of his career in commercial real estate. So it's not like that strategy's foreign to him. I think they're just sort of holding their cards close to the vest to see how this thing plays. I mean, like I said earlier, they're trying to run it hot and see if that they can grow their way out of this situation. But and a big part of that is they want to get the Fed easing so that interest rates come down so they can refinance as much debt as possible at the lowest interest rates possible. So this to me is more like a nuclear option. This is not just, hey, we're just going to introduce this for no particular reason. This is something they do specifically if they start to lose control of the bond market and they're trying to do a Hail Mary, just fix things in one fell swoop.
And going back to that idea of the downstream consequences, Graham, what do you think happens to gold miners if
Oh, there you go.
in both cases of,
Yeah.
revaluing to market price and or, a much higher than market price?
Well, if you revalue market price, the effect, I mean, there wouldn't be an immediate effect in the sense that, like, so if you revalue gold at 10,000 an ounce, obviously gold miners just go through the roof. Like their reserves are automatically doubled in value just overnight. But if you revalue at market rate, that's a different story because you're not actually changing the price of gold. All you're doing is, implicitly linking the dollar to gold again. And you're also creating an environment in which it's sort of unquantifiable, but you're signaling that the largest owner of everything in the world, the US government, is now viewing gold as an asset that's worthy of attention. Gold's been considered this kind of relic for decades. No one wanted to own it, no one cared. That's changed dramatically. No one's ever talked about gold other than Ron Paul, I should say. Like nobody in a position of major power has really talked about how important gold is forever. The idea was gold was some kind of like Warren Buffett said, it just sits there and looks at you. It's not worth owning. That's all changed. We're in a completely new regime. Central banks have been buying 1,000 tons of gold a year since 2022. Because gold's gone up in price, they now, their holdings of gold is worth more than their holdings of treasuries based as a percentage of foreign reserves for the first time since the mid-90s. So you've got central banks buying gold, you've got retail getting into gold aggressively to the point that I'm sure you've seen there's photos of people lining up to buy it around the world. And then the big other thing is Wall Street's advocating you own gold. Morgan Stanley, for decades, the way portfolios were structured was 60% stocks, 40% bonds. Morgan Stanley is the first, but others are joining in saying, no, you should do 60% stocks, 20% bonds, 20% gold. Now, to most people, they're probably like, well, who cares? Why does that matter? Well, the reason that matters is that the largest pools of capital in the world, the pension funds, the hedge funds, the guys that manage hundreds, if not trillions of dollars worth of capital, they follow what Wall Street says. And if Wall Street's now advocating that's how you should break down your portfolio, that means that these large pools of capital that haven't even considered gold worthy of their interest for decades are actually going to start allocating capital to gold. Gold market's not that large. I think the total investable gold out there is like $3 trillion. I'm talking investable, not jewelries and things. And gold miners, all the gold miners in the U.S., trading on the stock market are only worth about $600 billion. So you've got the situation where these deep pockets are starting to move into gold for the first time in decades, including central banks who can literally print currency at will. I mean, it's an environment where gold's in a completely new regime.
So, Graham, going back to this macro, let's say, lens of the credit cycle that we're currently under, we've seen several central banks, as you mentioned, off the top here, cutting rates over the past 24 months. So, does this rate cutting cycle culminate in a massive stimulus spend catalyzed by possibly the markets crashing because of, tightening liquidity conditions at this point?
No, I think we're more likely to see what I call, well, we're at a weird crossroads, let's put it that way. We're either going to see a melt up where just, currencies are devalued so aggressively. I mean, think about it this way. So we never really returned to the pre-pandemic norms, but we have debt levels that are far, far higher. And inflation never really truly got tamed. And you've got every major central bank, with the exception of Japan, now easing, cutting rates. On top of that, the Fed and the Bank of Canada are going to end quantitative tightening. They're going to be forced to launch quantitative easing in the near future. It's highly likely that the European Central Bank, the Bank of England, have to do the same. So you're in an environment in which the U.S. economy, which is the largest economy of the world, is actually larger than the second and third, and I think even the fourth economies combined. We're now growing our economy still, but the Fed's aggressively easing, and that can very likely create what I call the great global melt-up, an environment where just capital is forced to move out of cash into risk assets. And so I think there's a decent chance that happens. But the flip side of it, and this is the big red flag I've been trying to pay attention to, is the AI theme. If you look at since the bull market started in 2022, AI stocks have accounted for 75% of S&P 500 gains, 80% of profits, and 90% of CapEx. I mean, the S&P 500 is effectively one gigantic bet on AI. A lot of people think AI is in a bubble. That's up for debate, depending on your definition of a bubble. For sure, there's pockets of the AI trade that are just trading at ludicrous valuations, but the big hyperscalers, Meta, Amazon, Microsoft, those guys have hundreds of billions in cash flow. Like, it's not like 99 or the tech bubble where like these were companies that had no cash or nothing to speak of. These are companies that are financially very sound. So you could make a claim that AI is not really AI as one gigantic play is not in a bubble, just pockets of it are. But the big concern there is that if anything goes awry with the AI theme, because AI is so significant to the market based on the weighting and structure of the S&P 500. If that situation is such that suddenly AI turns out to be a dud, let's say it becomes evident that all of these hype and hope that AI is going to produce a boost in productivity, that it's going to, create incredible growth, that it's going to boost corporate profits. If that turns out to be incorrect, or that it's not going to happen anytime soon, that it's going to be like the internet where, in the late 90s, everybody said the internet's going to change the whole world. But the reality was you didn't really see these internet companies like Amazon and Alphabet, which used to be Google, start going bananas until like 5, 10 years down the road. If AI is the same thing, meaning you have this massive build out and it doesn't actually translate to incredible profits anytime soon, it's more like 5 years from now, then you could very well see another major bear market in stocks just based on, the reality not being anywhere near the hype. So I, you know, my the pieces I've been putting out to clients recently, specifically, I've been noting that my basic framework is we're in this melt up, we're in this run it hot macro regime where you devalue the currency and you're trying to force capital into risk assets. The idea being you do that, if real estate and stocks go through the roof, you boost household net worth, people feel wealthier, they go out, they spend more money, the economy continues to chug along. But that's contingent on AI continuing to stay intact. If AI blows up, or if the AI trade disappoints in some significant fashion, you could very easily see a bear market in 2026. But then that just quickly changes course because the Fed and everyone's forced to go nuclear with monetary policy to try and stop, a systemic crisis happening. And that's when the things just go absolutely bananas in the risk assets stage. Yeah.
So, again, just to kind of, I guess, make this more explicit,
Yeah.
what do you think catalyzes all of these governments to have to return to QE?
Well, the United States is going to have to do it just by virtue of the way the repo market. I mean, this is going to start getting really technical. The way I'd explain this to people who don't want to waste their time understanding the plumbing of the financial system is that, we're actually in something of a liquidity crunch right now. Now, that sounds preposterous because the Fed's cutting rates, inflation hasn't really been tamed, and you've got stocks near all-time highs, or they were recently, gold near all-time highs, Bitcoin near all-time highs, real estate at all-time highs. So how can you argue that there's not enough liquidity? Well, behind the scenes, the reality is that because the United States is issuing so much debt and financial institutions typically buy it, there's not a lot of free-floating liquidity in the banking system right now. The Fed likes to have $3 trillion in reserves floating around. It broke below that for the first time in a long time. And you're getting into a situation where, oh, I'm trying not to get technical here. You're getting into a situation where the liquidity is tight enough that banks are willing to pay a higher rate to get their money parked with the Fed so that they can get overnight liquidity to sort of meet their financial needs. So we actually have something of a liquidity crunch starting to unfold. And a big reason for this is the Fed has drained so much liquidity via quantitative tightening that there's a shortage and it's forcing the banks to turn to the Fed as kind of a lender of last resort for, it's called the repo market, but basically it's just overnight funding. So you're looking for capital just overnight till the next day opens. You're actually starting to see desperation for that coming from banks. And that's a sign that the Fed took things too far. And that's why you're suddenly seeing this pivot where the Fed says, oh, we're ending QT. And then, John Williams, who runs the New York branch of the Federal Reserve, which is that's the branch of the Fed that's responsible for market operations, actually buying and selling things. He's suddenly saying we need to do QE a lot sooner than people think. That's so if the Fed's going to be forced to do QE, whether they want to or not, sometime in the near future. The other ones are probably going to follow suit just by virtue of the fact that central banks, it's all they know how to do is print money and buy things. And outside of the United States, a lot of the world's not doing great. Japan's on the verge of recession. Germany's in a recession. Much of Europe is moving towards recession. Central banks are going to have to do something to try and keep things afloat.
And I think this also is kind of reinforced by the idea of the deterioration of much of the US data, which whether that's the job market, the inflation numbers, any number of these data points, right?
So the United States is in this really weird situation where some people call it like a K economy, where it's like the top 10% of the country is doing fantastic because those are the people that own stocks, that own real estate, that own, financial assets that are going up. The bottom 90% of the United States isn't doing anywhere near as well by virtue of the fact that these are people who, the higher cost of living, their incomes aren't rising and they don't own as many assets as the top 10%. In fact, a lot of them don't own anything in terms of real estate stocks, that the cost of living has gone up more rapidly than their incomes and they don't have the wealth effect of owning assets. For a lot of those people, like the situation has been quite dire for months now. And that's why you're getting this weird environment where, Ferrari has these fantastic results selling these cars, or, some of the really high-end fancy parts of Las Vegas are still doing well, but all of the lower level stuff is terrible. And you're seeing things like the number of delinquencies on credit cards spiking, the delinquencies on auto loans spiking. But, it's because we're in this weird K environment for the economy. And as a result of that, and also immigration policies and other things, the economic data has just gotten bizarre in our country. That's the big problem a lot of people run into with economic analysis, is they think a job is a job no matter what. And that's factually incorrect. A job is not, what a job, the value of a job now versus 10 years ago, 20 years ago, it's a totally different environment. And you run into this. I just use the word job as like an economic data point, but the reality is the data points all mean different things in different cycles. And in our current cycle, consider something like immigration. As everyone's aware, the Trump administration is being very aggressive in terms of limiting immigration. They're trying to deport people who are here illegally. And what is the secondary effect of that is we start seeing a credit crunch in the subprime auto loan side of the credit markets, because there are these companies that specialized in making high interest auto loans to people that are here, that are undocumented. And a lot of those people are now leaving. And so those loans are defaulting. And so you're starting to see a credit crunch in that part of the economy. So, my point here is that every environment's different, and you can't do an apples to apples comparison of the economy now versus 5 years ago or even 10 years ago or whatever. So it actually gets a lot more complicated. What we are seeing, though, is we're in this bizarre situation where, provided the top 10% of the economy or of incomes, the people who are in the top 10% continue to just spend like they are, the economy kind of just sort of chugs along. We never fully roll over into recession. And that's sort of what's been, that's why so many people have been so frustrated, I would say, because they keep thinking a recession's just around the corner. But the problem is that there's such wealth concentration, the top 10% is spending so much that in the aggregate, the economy continues to do well, even though, the bottom 80% of the income quartiles in our country, for a lot of those people, it's like we've been in a recession for years now. So it's an unfortunate situation where the haves and the have-nots have really different economic experiences in our country.
Graham, if we go back to this era of QE, or I guess I should say when we go back to that, what does that do to inflation, considering that we haven't seen it get back to the, let's say, the previous Fed target of 2%?
My view is that we're going to see another round of inflation. I don't see how we don't. It's the run it hot macro framework is one in which you're willing to get growth by any means necessary, even if it does unleash inflation. And that's kind of what the Trump administration has admitted they want to do. They're thinking, well, you know what we'll do is we'll get the Fed to cut rates now, get rates as low as possible, roll over as much debt as we possibly can, lock it in, and then if inflation comes back, start raising rates, because at that point we've locked in as much debt as we can at the lowest interest rate possible. And they're open about that. That like we're fine with that happening. Kind of crazy if you consider the suffering that another round of inflation would create for this country. But that's how they talk about these things. But yeah, you're absolutely right. The United States dollar lost like 11% of its value the first half of this year. And if you've got the Fed now easing rates, if you've got clear signs that inflation's bottoming. You look, even if you look at the official inflation metrics, like the consumer price index or the personal consumption expenditure, you don't have to be a master chart reader to see that they came down a lot and then they've sort of just flatlined. Like inflation, even the highly manipulated official data points are clearly not going down anymore. So, you start funneling money into this, you start printing dollars and using them to buy assets. I don't see how we don't have another round of inflation.
And to contribute to that, Graham, do you think that the, basically the tariffs that Trump brought in, do you think that that contributes to this inflationary environment?
I actually don't. I think t tariffs actually tend to be more deflationary. I think they force people to cut back on spending. And in fact, the Fed just came out with it. That was the craziest thing. So they launched the trade war, they introduced tariffs, and the Fed's out there saying, this is going to cause inflation. We're totally certain it's going to cause inflation. Trust us, we know for a fact inflation's coming. And the Fed has more economic PhDs on staff than any entity in the United States. They've got 400 economics PhDs. They've got 150 academic researchers that are helping those 400 PhDs. So you assume when these guys come out and say this stuff, they're like, oh, well, they must have something to back this up. Well, they just came out with a study last week that said, well, we've analyzed 150 years worth of tariffs. We found they don't cause inflation at all. And so what were you using to like back up your
Water.
arguments that, yeah, what were you just pulling this out of thin air? Unfortunately, they were. Unfortunately, the Fed is a political entity, and it's very clear the Fed doesn't like the Trump administration and is perfectly happy to pick fights with him, which is why Trump has just made it open that he hates the Fed. He's going to take them over basically by forcing the people to resign or replacing them with his own picks. I'm not saying that's good. I'm not saying that's bad. It's just the reality of where we are right now. And the result of the Fed, easing monetary conditions when if the Fed's going to ease monetary conditions when we're already running deficit to GDP of 6%, I don't see how you're not going to get another round of inflation. Like the effect just on the currency alone is going to be inflationary. And the tariffs, I don't think they necessarily trigger inflation. I think they force people to just stop buying as much as they do. So I don't really see that as being a huge result. I don't think. Let's put it this way. If the tariffs were going to result in a spike in inflation, it probably would have already happened. I think what is going to create a spike in inflation is the fact the government's spending so much money and the Fed's going to ease at the same time.
Graham, all of these things being considered, let's say this
Yeah.
crossroads we find ourselves at right now, when
Right.
we go back into QE, what do you think is the best place for investors to kind of position themselves in? Obviously we've talked about this from a very gold-centric point of view,
Yeah.
but in a melt-up situation, does everything just kind of participate in
Yeah.
that rally?
Yeah, it would. So, a big problem for a lot of gurus is they get really doom and gloom, and they like to pick out data points that look bad, but a lot of times those data points don't actually have a causality. There are data points that are, there's a lot of stuff. You need to think of it this way. 53% of household net worth is tied up to equities at this point. So stocks going up is pretty much a matter of national security. It sounds ridiculous, but
A good
like,
way to put it.
yeah, it is. I mean, the reality, that's why they always save stocks. Eventually they panic and save stocks. Why? Because if you have a really prolonged, nasty bear market where stocks lose like 30%, if you have another financial crisis where we lose 50%, you erase tens of trillions of dollars of household, you're bankrupting vast swaths of the consumer. Like it's depression time. So the reality is they always move to save stocks. And as a result of that and other things, historically stocks go up. The reality is stocks typically, if you look at a long-term chart of the stock market, it's up. And so typically you want to be exposed to stocks, but the way you need to think about it is you need to think about it as you ride it as long as you possibly can. And then your goal is try and get out before a bear market hits. So you keep as much of your winnings as possible so that you can then start buying when the bear market's bottoming out and you get everything at a discount. That's how you make money in the long term. I'm not a big believer in just riding it out through a bear market. I think get out before a bear market happens. So, what I'm telling clients right now is like my base case for the financial system is we're in a melt-up. We're really heavily allocated to stocks. We anticipated the current correction and dip that's happening. It was coming to us based on our sort of proprietary way of reading the market. But we don't think this is the end of the bull market. We think this is a garden variety correction. We're going to 7,000 by year end. And if AI stays intact, and it's not unreasonable to think we could see the S&P 500 hit 8,000 by the end of next year. I mean, if you're in an environment where the currency is losing double digits, in value every year based on devaluation, and the Fed's engaged in quantitative easing while cutting rates, and the economy is still growing, and we're running a deficit equal to 6% of GDP. I mean, there's $7 trillion in money markets. That money's going to eventually get out of cash and go into risk assets to try and maintain its purchasing power. So,
Seems to be the environment that you would absolutely need to hold assets in.
exactly. I mean, realistically, I don't see how we don't end up in an environment where you have to just own assets to try to accrue. I mean, that's been the name of the game for decades now. There's a famous interview with Janet Yellen, I think when she was Fed chair in like 2013, and someone said to her, how do people move up the food chain finance? I mean, this wasn't verbatim, but it was something like, how do you move up the food chain financially in this country? And she's like, you have to own assets. Like, she point blank said, you have to own assets. Because the reality is incomes, unless you're going to become a surgeon or a lawyer or someone whose income's just really high and growing, you're going to get wealthy from owning something as opposed to your incomes. Your income is there for you to funnel away as much money into investing capital as possible for retirement down the road. So, my view is that you want to be long risk assets most of the time. The key is having certain metrics you use, and I have ones I recommend to clients that you just sidestep it when things start coming unhinged. And then you do some shorts, you do some hedges, you move into defensive allocations. But your goal is let's say a bull market has eight parts. Nobody times the bottom or the top perfectly. Doesn't happen. Even the masters of the universe get that stuff wrong. So don't even try to pick a top or bottom. Your goal is try and get the middle six of the 8 points. Like, miss the first eighth, miss the last eighth. Try and get the bulk of it, and then sidestep, even if it means you miss out some of the eventual stuff, but just figure out what it is that works for you, that you sidestep it. So you try to avoid, let's say, 75% of the bear market. If you had done that with every bull market starting in 2000, you'd be worth, multiple fortunes at this point. If you hadn't done that, stocks went over from 96 to 2013. If you look at the stock market, it's just one gigantic sideways consolidation. So that's why I say, your goal from a financial perspective is ride risk assets as long as you can, sidestep before the bear market happens, and then look to load up when things are starting to bottom out again.
On the other side of this, just to, play devil's advocate here, Graham, what do you think is a possible risk? Like, if we see, let's say, more active conflict breaking out, would that, derail this path forward that we've laid out?
Yeah, there's always risk, isn't there? War is inflationary. I don't like talking about the loss of human life in economic terms, but the reality is war is inflationary. You look at what happened in world. Actually, probably the best proxy for what we went through with the pandemic was World War II. If you get rid of the pandemic and just simply look at what the policymakers did as a wartime kind of policy framework, print a ton of money, buy as much debt as possible, use it to finance the economy growing as much as possible. But instead of financing war, you're trying to finance, papering over a shutdown. That's the closest thing you've got to a proxy for what we just did. War is inflationary. You're printing money, you're using, and then you're using up, you're using hard assets to try and finance the war effort. Global conflict, it might cause a brief hiccup, but the reality is, at the end of the day, the single biggest risk to the stock market right now, barring another pandemic or just crazy exogenous event, is the AI trade blowing up. If the AI trade blows up, all bets are off. But other than that, it's melt up time until things come off, the wheels come off.
Excellent. Well, Thank you for laying all of this out for us, Graham. You know, there's
My
so many
pleasure.
things to take into consideration here, but
Yeah.
you know, I hope we did a good job to help listeners understand all of this. Is there anything that you'd like to leave people with to think about before we wrap up here?
I mean, we've covered a lot. Just the simplest way I like sort of bullet points is just think of it this way. There's too much debt in the financial system. The people who are in charge of things, the only thing they really know how to do is print money. And it's very difficult to see an environment where they don't just keep doing what they've been doing, which is, the dollar's lost 30% of its value since 2008. And I don't see that changing. So the reality is you need to invest. If you're just sitting on savings, you're just sitting in cash, and you're going to see your purchasing power continue to erode. And unfortunately, that's the way the system's set up. It's best not to fight it. A lot of guys, they rant and rave about how it's wrong and it shouldn't be this way. But unfortunately, that's the tune the devil's playing. So you got to dance to it if you want to make out ahead in this financial system we're in. But there's plenty of ways to play that, whether it's owning gold or stocks or real estate. The main thing is you just don't want to be sitting in cash. Cash is what you want to be in when deflation hits, so that you can then buy stocks at the bottom.
Absolutely. Well said, Graham. Of course, for anybody that wants to read more of Graham's work, he publishes his articles at gainspainscapital.com. Of course, on X at G Summers MBA. And of course, the book that you mentioned, Into the Abyss, Life After the Bubble, is available on Amazon. Graham, thanks so much for your time today.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.